This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears, and tonight I am flying solo with this show. Bradley and his wife Leah had their baby. Baby Jules was born last week. We're very pleased to welcome her. Number three baby for the podcast, so we're very proud of her as well. Bradley and Leah and the whole family are doing just great, so we look forward to having Bradley back in a couple of weeks' time, but he's going to take a couple of weeks off just to do all the usual baby things that we do. And between he and I, we're getting quite good at this whole business of bringing up little babies. So tonight we've got two sponsors for the show, the first being Jam Software, who provide IT staff with enterprise tools that power widespread use of Apple technologies such as Macs, iPads, iPhone and Apple TV in education. More about them at jamsoftware.com. And secondly, the show is brought to you by Shobi, an iPad app for paperless classrooms. Shobi makes it easy to assign, collect and review student work and provide rich feedback with annotations, voice notes, grades and more. And I'll tell you more about both of those as the show goes on. So tonight I'm struggling to do this show because Google Drive is having an outage right now. So I do have my notes, but I don't have any other notes, which is good times. So we'll try and get through the show as best we can. Okay, so we're going to continue our series. It's probably going to be a shorter show tonight just because I'm here myself and I don't have Bradley to chip in his good part to the show as well. So we're looking at the book Diffusion of Innovations by Everett Rogers. And we are several chapters through it now. We're looking at chapter 10, which is called Innovation in Organizations tonight. And some of the things that are quite interesting about that chapter is that, in part, Rogers gives his fellow diffusion researchers kind of a hard time for the way that they deal with some of this stuff. And it's quite interesting because most of the work in diffusion research seems to have been done around the decisions made by individuals to adopt or not to adopt, rather than organizations as a whole or larger entities. It tends to have been focused much more on the individual and their decisions. And I think in large part, what they find when they look at organizations is that most of the same rules apply. But there's another slightly different model that Rogers talks about in terms of how organizations come to adopt an innovation. And I think it's worth having a look at that just now. The first thing that Rogers kind of hits his fellow researchers for is the fact that quite often what you find with diffusion studies about organizations is that they just seem to see that larger organizations are more innovative, which is kind of contrary to what you might think, because we tend to think of smaller organizations as being nimble and agile, whereas large organizations are big lumbering brutes that take forever to adopt anything and really innovate on the cutting edge, as we find. And what Rogers says about that is he sort of slams his colleagues a little bit by suggesting that one of the reasons why most of these studies show that larger organizations are more innovative is because it's easy to find out whether an organization is large or small. That's an easy measurement to make. Therefore, it's the one that people make. And I think what he's really calling for there is he's calling for people to do a better job of digging into the actual real reasons why one organization might be more innovative than another. Those real reasons might lie a little bit deeper. And the other thing that he hits people for is he says, it's quite possible that the answers that a CEO or a CTO gives to an innovation researcher actually doesn't reflect the reality of adoption. That what the management think is happening with the adoption in an organization, what's actually happening, might well be two completely different things. And I think in terms of education, we certainly see this sometimes when we talk to people who, you know, you might talk to somebody at a kind of school district level or even higher who will tell you, oh yeah, we're totally on board with iPad, or we've totally adopted iTunes U. And in fact, when you go into one of the schools that they're supposed to run, in fact, they haven't really adopted anything like that. They've got some, and it's not the real same thing as completely adopting or wholeheartedly adopting that kind of technology. So there is that kind of gap between where the kind of people that researchers tend to talk to, the higher level people, and then the actual people at the coalface. And I think this is true of many ways of measuring education. The things that they do is that they talk to researchers and even journalists, I suppose, talk to high level people who will give them chapter and verse about what has happened in schools. And then you actually, if you go and talk to the teachers, you'll find out that what's actually happened is substantially different to the measurement that's been given at the high level. So what are some of the reasons why these big organizations might appear to be more innovative beyond just their simple size? And Rogers gives really three or four different reasons why, depending on sort of how you count the way he writes. But the first one is that it may simply be that bigger organizations just have, in total, more resources. They've got more money, they've got more people, they've got more facilities. And in keeping with the general attributes of early adopters and innovators in the question of innovativeness and adopter categories, in keeping with that, the more wealthy, the more educated, the more able grouping, perhaps just a wealthier organization with more resources might be able to do innovations more. The second aspect is that he talks about the possibility of slack resources, which is resources that an organization has above and beyond that which it needs to run its organization. So small school exceeders, we don't have a lot of slack resources. We're running in a very tight ship. You know, just thinking about today, I spent most of the day driving the bus to and from the PE because I had to cover for somebody who wasn't available today. So, you know, quite often I'm driving the bus and I'm thinking, you know, all those years in the computer science lab and this is what I'm doing with my life. But it's a nice way to get out of the school sometimes. But the point being that, you know, a small organization just doesn't have the same kind of spare resources as a large organization would. So that the availability of additional people and additional time is one of the ways in which innovation can happen. And the one that comes to mind immediately is Google's classic 20% time, where Google employees would be given 20% of their working time to work on any project that interested them. And the list of things that have come out of that for Google are actually very, very substantial. Things like AdWords, which is in some ways is like the basis of all of Google's business now. That was a 20% project, I believe, as was Gmail at the time as well. So there's certainly benefits to having slack time that can be used for additional things. And I always kind of wonder how could we build in 20% time for teachers? You know, well, of course, we could just hire more teachers. I mean, that's one way to do it. But what would that look like if teachers were just given, I don't know, one day a week just to teach whatever it was they wanted to teach? Wouldn't that be wonderful? Maybe. Might not be for everybody, but I think some teachers would really come alive with that kind of opportunity. And you would see a lot of very interesting innovations there as well. There's two other things that Rogers talks about in big organizations that also might contribute to their increasing innovativeness. One is technical expertise. Simply put, bigger organizations have more people who more or less know what they're doing or are highly technical and highly expert in certain fields. And you might have somebody on site who knows about X, Y, or Z thing that you want to innovate, whereas a smaller organization might have to hire in expertise, and that expertise might not necessarily be the best that they can possibly afford. The final one is just sheer organizational structure, that a large organization might have the capability of making it possible for some people to go away and build another division and do their work there. And the obvious example there is the venerable Skunk Works at Lockheed Martin, which was a division of the organization that was made completely separate, even, I believe, to the point of having their own building on the site. And they went away and they innovated in ways that the mainstream organization couldn't. So when you are a smaller organization, perhaps that kind of additional facility, that offsite, is not really possible. And you see that kind of thing happening today, even with, you know, this Project Titan that Apple is supposedly involved in, which is apparently Apple's project to build a car. That has been done away from Infinite Loop. It's been done away from Apple's core offices and core buildings, and they found additional facilities where that team can work in quiet and in private. And the one person at Apple who did that more than anybody was Steve Jobs himself when they were building the Macintosh. He took the team away, hoisted a pirate flag outside, and turned that into, you know, an insurgency within the company, if you like. And that's an option that's available to very few small organizations that have that kind of additional facility somewhere around about. In schools, it's often very, very, very difficult to have that kind of organizational structure available to you. The best one we can think of is, you know, we referred to, I think, last week or the week before, where we were talking about teachers being seconded out of their job into some other organization to do their work. And that's almost the kind of Skunk Works thing, but the difficulty is you're still taking the teacher out of the school into some completely separate organization rather than making a group within the school. And sometimes you can build alliances across a couple of subjects within the school, but it's often generally very difficult because there are so many sort of standards and constant constraints on teachers to get them that kind of free time and that free space to do that kind of innovative work. So those are some of the reasons why big organizations might appear to be innovative beyond their simple size. They have more resources, they have more Slack resources, more technical expertise on site, and their organizational structure might be able to be adapted to afford more time and space to innovate. Let me take a moment to tell you about Jamz Software. Jamz Software provide IT staff with enterprise tools that power widespread use of Apple technologies such as Macs, iPads, iPhone, and Apple TV in education. And now with Casper Focus, they've placed these great technologies directly into the hands of teachers who work with students every day. Casper Focus is an app that runs on the teacher iPad that allows teachers to quickly gain students' attention, conduct secure exams within an app, even select the specific Apple TV assigned to their class, choose and distribute iBooks, and even begin AirPlay right from Casper Focus. You can learn more about what you can do with Casper Focus at jamfsoftware.com. That's jamfsoftware.com. Okay, so back to the innovation in large organizations. One of the things that Rogers brings out in this chapter is he talks about a different, slightly different model for organizational adoption of innovations to individual adoption of innovations. And what he says is that in an organization, there are two major phases in innovation. Now, we've talked about the innovation decision process for individuals, but in organizations, he looks at two major phases and then he breaks down one phase into two parts and one phase into three parts. And those two phases are firstly initiation and secondly implementation. And the initiation phase is where the organization begins to approach innovations and starts to match up what they need or what their agenda is with what the innovation might provide for them. So he talks about a number of organizational attributes that may help or hinder the initiation phase, but they can often work in the opposite direction in implementation. He talks about three different attributes in particular: the degree of centralization in the organization, the complexity, and what I think it's a bit of an unfortunate term he uses there, because what he means by complexity in this context is he means the general level of skill and ability that the organization's employees have to do their job. And the third attribute is low or high degree of formalization of work processes in the organization. So what he says is, for example, a highly decentralized, highly complex, but low formality organization might innovate a lot more. They might initiate a lot more innovations, but they might struggle to formalize them. Right? And you can think about that in terms of classic digital startup companies. They're not very centralized, typically a very disparate organization, typically often remote workers. High complexity of the employees, you know, very, very high skilled operation, and low formality, low process. And those organizations might adopt lots of new things. You see it classically, you know, in the adoption of, for example, new programming languages, you know, Scala, Go, Rust, whatever it is they're looking at. And startups are tend to be known for sort of pushing the envelope on tool choice and languages, but struggle to formalize them. And the great startups are the ones that get over that bridge from being a sort of scrappy insurgent to being a new sustainable large organization. The opposite way around, though, centralized organizations with low complexity but high formalization might struggle to initiate innovation, but when they do, they formalize it really well. And the one I always think of when you mention that is McDonald's. It's a highly centralized, low complexity, high formalization organization. So, you know, McDonald's summer franchises, I believe, I'm not an expert on this by any means, but many of them are, you know, McDonald's facilities. Is the people who work at McDonald's are not highly technically skilled. You know, they're not, you know, multi-year trained chefs as such. And the formalization of the process is actually very high. If you ever watch what goes on in a McDonald's, there's, you know, if you've ever been to McDonald's more than once, your Big Mac is the same, no matter whether you're buying it in Boston or Buenos Aires, whatever time of the day, whatever time of the night, whatever language is being spoken, whatever you called it to get it, that Big Mac is the same thing worldwide. And that's a high formalization organization. So when McDonald's does bring in a new innovation, they tend to formalize it very well, even though they might not actually be that innovative overall, if you think about it. But those two things can work differently in both initiation and implementation. So the fast and loose startup can initiate a lot of innovations, but they struggle to formalize them and make them something that everybody does in the team. Whereas a centralized, low complexity organisation like McDonald's might not innovate that much, but when they do, they can roll it out worldwide. And I was wondering, where does the school fit in this? Which one of these is a school? And I actually think that in some ways, the school is actually much more like a startup than it is like McDonald's. It's highly decentralized. Every teacher has, in large part, a lot of autonomy as to exactly how they do things in their own classroom. Teachers are very highly trained. They have a lot of skills that they need to teach. And in some ways, a school is still quite a low formalization organization. It's not something, we don't operate like surgeons or pilots, where we have checklists, we certainly do have documentation, but we don't have, you know, every day I come into the classroom, I check off these 10 things that I do. And then for every pupil, I check off these 5 things, where it's a lot more kind of flexible and loose than that in most cases. So the school, I think, really falls more on the side of initiating more innovations, but struggling to formalize them. And I think you see this many, many times when you look at, for example, iPad deployments in schools. There are tens of thousands of iPads in schools in Scotland alone, and possibly hundreds of thousands in the UK overall. But what you're finding is that those, in many cases, those are schools that have initiated an innovation, but are genuinely right now struggling to totally formalize those innovations. And what I mean by formalize in this case is make it a standard thing that the entire school does on a sustainable basis. And you know, Bradley and I have talked about this before, where you're looking at a situation where the deployment gets started on the back of a pot of money that is found somewhere, somehow, out of some budget. And you can get iPads, you can start using them, you might even use them quite effectively, but what you will not do is you will not get to a situation where everybody in the school has an iPad ready to go for whatever they want to do with access to the network at any time. And that's the thing that schools are trying to get over. And I talk to schools who are trying to get over that right now, is how do they go from having some iPads in school to a formalized thing that this is what this organization does day in, day out for years. And I think that's a real challenge to get across that hurdle of innovation here. How do we formalize it? Quite a tricky one to think about. I want to talk next about the two stages that Rogers breaks down in initiation. He talks about initiation being broken down into, firstly, agenda setting and then matching. Now, agenda setting is when a general organizational problem makes an innovation desirable. Rogers talks about the possibility of a performance gap opening up that makes it obvious to everybody in the organization that some kind of innovation is needed. Or alternatively, he talks about an external shock to the organization making change obvious and required. And the phrase that you know for this is never let a crisis go to waste. And I think that's actually very true as a management technique, is whenever something happens, something in a crisis mode, there's a great opportunity there to make radical changes to the organization. And I would certainly never let it go to waste if I could avoid it. He says in agenda setting, similarly to the discovery of innovations for the individual, that sometimes it's the need in the organization that triggers a search for the innovation, and sometimes it's the knowledge of the innovation that triggers the need. And this is okay. Now, you've probably been in situations, or you've heard of schools where teachers want to get iPads, for example, in the classroom. And what happens is that either management, or perhaps more often IT, come back and say, right, will you tell us what you're going to use them for? And then once we're satisfied that your business case is sound in the language that they like to use, we'll go ahead and get your iPads for you. And that kind of requires the teachers to firstly know what it is they want to do with it. Now, maybe it isn't in this case that they've learned about the iPad first, and then they want to think about how could we use that in school. But demands for fully worked out use cases and usage scenarios is sometimes used as a brake on progress. And it can act as a brake on progress, because not only do the teachers perhaps not know all the things they could do with them, but as they learn, they will discover other things that they could do with them. And one of my concerns for a long time with iPads that are brought into schools for specific purposes is that you can sometimes limit them to those purposes, right? So let's take, for example, we might want to improve literacy scores in the school, however those literacy scores are measured. And then somebody in the school organization hears about the iPad or sees the iPad, or as a result of their research comes across the iPad, and they say, okay, we've got a target for literacy. We're going to bring in the iPad to improve literacy. Let's do that. And let's say that that program begins and it runs correctly. The problem you've got then is that the iPad is seen as the tool for literacy. It's not seen as a general purpose tool for education. And that's something I'm concerned about, because if the iPads can, or any technology deployment for that matter, if they come to be seen as just the thing that we got for this purpose, they tend to be thought of as only for that purpose. And I think that misses out a huge swathe of the potential that general purpose computers have for improving learning and improving the life of your school. So that's agenda setting. And it's all, what that's really about is that's about the organization knowing what their priorities are. Once we know that, the next stage is matching, right? And what Rogers talks about there is he talks about a problem from the organization's agenda gets matched with an innovation. So that's when you look at your problem, literacy, and you say, I want to get iPads. And one of the concerns I have about teachers looking at technology is that it's often the best teachers in the school who can see the learning value in almost anything. I mean, you've probably met them the same way I have. I have some colleagues like this who you could give them a box of lollipop sticks and a rubber band and they could invent a lesson out of that that would be amazing and people would learn from it and it would be fantastic. And sometimes I'm a little bit concerned that, you know, teachers can go to, say, let's say a technology event where they see all different kinds of technology and they look at everything and they can imagine how everything could be used in the classroom. And it's actually very easy for a good teacher to match any problem they know of in the school with just about any technology. And this is where a little bit of subtlety and a little bit of leadership comes in, is, yeah, let's think about the literacy problem. I could go to the Bet Show in London and I could match my literacy problem against 15 different solutions. And then the question is, which one are we going to do? And one of the dangers there is that you fall into this trap of saying, let's just get the best tool for the job. And what that often means is you end up with 15 different tools. And instead of making that decision on the front end, you're constantly making that decision on the back end. Oh, I have to think today, what's my job? What's the tool for the job today? What's the tool for the job today? And of course, yes, we do that at small levels, but to do that at the high level of like, what computing platform am I going to use? I think that's a crazy making situation. I think some people could be driven a little bit insane by that. You know, if you come in every day and the first, you've got to sort of derive from first principles every day, what computer am I going to use today? I've got a Chromebook, I've got an Android tablet, I've got an iPad here, I've got an Xbox, I've got a desktop PC. What am I going to use for this problem? And if you go make that decision every single day, I think that's going to take its toll on some people, if not everybody. But the best tool for the job always sounds like a great option, but I think sometimes you've got to temper that with the reality, which is, let's just have some tools that are good for a lot of things and let's focus on using and learning those. But that's matching. A problem from the organization's agenda is matched with an innovation. And once you do get a stable match there, then I think you can start to do some good things, because you can start to then push through what Rogers calls the implementation stage. Let me take a break and tell you about Shobi, and we'll come back and talk about the implementation stage in a minute. Shobi is an iPad app for paperless classrooms. With Shobi, teachers can easily assign, collect, and review student work on their iPads, then provide rich feedback directly into documents through rich annotation features such as the pen tool and the text and voice notes. Students can show their learning creatively by submitting to Shobi from thousands of iPad apps or by using Shobi's built-in tools. New to Shobi this year is the gradebook feature for Shobi Pro, which allows teachers to easily add, review, and export student grades. More great features like student portfolios and parent access will be coming to Shobi this fall. Shobi Basic is 100% free, and individual teachers listening to this podcast will get Gradebook and the enhanced annotation features of Shobi Pro for 30% off if they purchase annually. Start your paperless classroom today by downloading Shobi in the App Store or by visiting shobi.com. That's shobie.com. Okay, so let's talk about implementation. Three stages are involved in implementation. We've got the initiation phase and we've got the implementation phase. In implementation, three things really happen. Firstly, there is a stage in which the innovation gets redefined. Now, if you remember when the adoption decision process that we talked about earlier in the series, when people adopt a new technology, they often reinvent it or redefine it in some way to match their requirements a little bit better. What happens here, Roger says, is the innovation gets reinvented to match the organization's needs, but sometimes, and if not often, the organization itself gets redefined in order to better match the innovation or to accommodate the innovation in some way. So one of the things that happened, or this is one of the reasons why I kind of spoke earlier against the idea of bringing in iPads or computers for just one particular purpose, is that you need to, what you're doing there is you're losing the possibility of the organization reinventing itself to fit the innovation. If you bring in iPads with less of an agenda for them, then you have the opportunity to change a lot more about what you do in school because you've got this technology in the school. And one of the things that can arise here, I think, also is frustration or friction or difficulty or some kind of impedance mismatch can arise when there are aspects of the organization's operation that are externally imposed but cannot change to take account of the innovation. So there's a couple of classic examples here. One is, of course, we've talked about this in the show many times, the externally assessed methods of, or the externally imposed methods of assessing work that is done in schools. So if you have an external exam board that has to set exams for a large group, diverse group of schools, that can't be changed just to suit your technology deployment. And that's something that we have found actually in the past couple of years is a big kind of jarring point in our iPad deployment, is that kids come up through school doing lots of progressive group-based work on computers, being marked digitally, being shared electronically and all that kind of stuff. And then they come to a point where I have to sort of say, stop, now we're printing everything out because eventually that's got to go sent away for an assessment. And that's something that I recognize perfectly well that the exam board can't change the entire structure of it just to suit my school. But it is just something to be aware of, that if you want to change your organization and you have externally imposed requirements, it's quite difficult. I'll give you another example is many healthcare organizations are subject to very strict data protection laws. So that does tend to hinder, for example, the adoption of things like cloud computing. Although I think as a computing industry as a whole, we're getting past that concern now. And you look at some of the work that Amazon Web Services, for example, have done in terms of ensuring compliance with laws like HIPAA, that they are clearly very sensitive to that. And if you look at the Information Commissioner's Office in the UK, they are very clear, their guidance on cloud computing is very clear that you should not avoid this technology just because of data protection. There are ways and means in order that you can actually comply as well as, if not actually better than before, because of your shift to cloud computing. So those are some external constraints that are being solved slowly, but they're being solved. But the other one that can sometimes hit schools is IT. And the reason I say that is because in certain situations in various countries, the school doesn't necessarily run its own IT. And so in some places, the people who run your IT are going to be a managed service provider that you buy in, and they have your IT provision is mediated by a legal contract, where if you want to innovate in one way and it's not in the contract, you just can't have that innovation because the managed service provider doesn't support it. And the longer you write those contracts for, you know, people are signing these contracts for 5 and 6 years at a time. If you signed a contract 5 years ago, it was probably negotiated 6 or 7 years ago. And quite a lot of things have been invented since then that you might want to use, but they're not part of your contract. So that's a quite difficult one. The other situation is where this happens in Scotland in particular. Some schools have their IT provided by the local authority. And the local authority's IT department, their job is not just to provide IT for schools, but to provide IT for all of the local authority's operations. So whatever that may be, the councillors themselves, the parks and recreation department, the library and the schools. And sometimes the schools want to innovate in a certain way and the corporate IT say, well, that's not compatible with our requirements for XYZ or the thing. So those are externally imposed things that cannot be changed by the organization itself. Because of their innovation, may want to change, but they end up bumping up against these other things that can't change. And that can be often be a source of frustration and friction. It's something definitely to be aware of if you're in that situation and you are planning a big innovation. The second stage in the phase of implementation is called clarifying. And clarifying happens when the innovation is put into more widespread use across the organization so that the meaning of the change becomes clear. And what Roger says about the meaning of an innovation is he says it's a social construction. And this will be familiar to, you know, people who are familiar with constructivist education, that people initially don't know how does this innovation work, don't know what it does, don't know who's going to be affected by it, and I have no idea how it's going to affect me. But as it becomes a thing that is spread out throughout the organization, people start talking about it and they gain a common understanding amongst themselves of this innovation. Therefore, the meaning of it is constructed as through those conversations as part of that social process. And this is one of the situations where if you don't diffuse your innovation widely enough throughout your organization, this never kind of becomes a thing that happens because you haven't reached that critical mass. So it's very difficult to get that clarifying step until everybody's got it. And you see this sometimes arising in situations where schools are doing a trial of the iPad, but they don't do a wide enough trial or they don't do a realistic enough trial. And what they end up with is, you know, we do a wee bit and you've seen an iPad once or twice. Now let's ask for your opinions and see what this innovation means for the school. But not enough people have seen it for long enough for them to actually make a valid judgment about it. So this is where, when you also adopt technology for overly specific goals, this is a bit of a high risk, because not only have you kind of pigeonholed the iPad as the thing that, you know, we've got them for literacy, or we've got them for science, or we've got them for STEM, or we've got them for perhaps additional needs pupils, which is a common reason why iPads come into certain schools in the first place, is first for ASN. And what happens there is that that can be all the iPads will ever become, because the meaning of this innovation has actually been imposed from outside. You end up in a situation where there's nothing to talk about, because we all know those iPads are for literacy or the iPads are for additional needs. They're not for whatever. And if you don't open up the possibility of the iPad being used in a more general, in a general way, then people will, the meaning will not be socially constructed. The meaning will be externally imposed by management or by the constraints of the budget or by the constraints of whatever system it was got those devices into the school in the first place. So giving that opportunity for clarifying is very important, because it means that people can decide for themselves what they think this innovation means for PE, for English, for history, for art. And what's quite interesting is you'll find that people have very different approaches to it depending on what you see. So an art teacher, for example, might construct the presence of an iPad in her classroom as being a great new canvas that students can express themselves on in a radically new way from previous materials. A PE teacher, on the other hand, might look at it as an amazing tool for doing video analysis of performance, which is a huge driver of iPad adoption in PE, by the way. Other teachers might see it, and a math teacher might see it as an incredibly powerful, much, much faster graphic calculator. A computing teacher might see it as a computing platform, a programming tool. An app like Pythonista, for example, which we're using this year, very, very powerful. History teacher might see it as the greatest research tool they've ever had in their classroom. They might have great access in a civics class to news and opinions from all over the country, or indeed all over the world, that they've never had access to before. And all those teachers might construct the meaning of this general purpose tool in their classroom in a different way. Whereas if you come in as a member of the management team and you say, hey, iPads, literacy, get it done. What else do you think iPads are ever going to be used for? People are just going to think that's for literacy. We'll get that out when we do literacy. We'll put them away again and I'll just keep doing the same thing that I've always done for the rest of it. So you run a big, big risk when you bring in that kind of new general purpose innovation and you don't let people reinterpret it for themselves. That's clarifying. And the final one is what Rogers calls routinizing. We've used this phrase before in terms of when we talked about the possibility of discontinuance of an innovation. What happens is if the innovation doesn't become routinized very quickly in an organization, it's quite often possible to discontinue the use of it. It doesn't become routine. But in the context of the organization, what Roger says is that when you're routinizing, the innovation has been incorporated so much into the work of the organization that the innovation loses its separate identity. So nobody gets really excited about the fact that their school's got email anymore, because everybody's got email. If you were to switch from email to Slack, for example, there would be a period of time where getting on Slack was the thing that everybody was talking about. And similarly for us at Cedars, when we were first doing the iPad, you know, I would say the first 2 or 3 years, that was what the school was about, was we're adopting iPad, we're learning about iPad, we're doing things on iPad, here are the new things we can do on iPad. And in the next development cycle after we did the adoption, the next development plan for the school didn't mention iPad very much at all, because by that point it had been routinized and it had lost its identity as the big new thing in the school. And the big new thing in the school became something else. It became the adoption of the new National 5 exams, for example. And that was our focus for the next development phase after that. But this is also where you can run into trouble, because if you don't do that routinized step, if you don't make it something that fades into the background in your school, then either you're still treating it as a brand new gimmick, or you're just not doing it anymore quite often. And this is one of the things that I think is quite concerning, is that we mentioned this in the last show as well, that one-to-one deployments seem to be quite vulnerable to discontinuance. And this idea of routinizing the idea of one-to-one is quite tricky. And I think what it really requires is, it just requires keeping on the road for a long time. Now, we're getting on for 6 years of iPad deployment, and we're about to do another deal for another 3 years. And by the end of nearly a decade, that's going to be routinized, and time takes care of a lot of this stuff. But if you don't try and accelerate that process in various ways, then that you leave yourself open to the risk of discontinuance at various points. So what does all this mean for schools? And I suppose notionally what it means is that you would think that bigger schools and bigger school districts should be more innovative than smaller schools. But I think this aspect of the school being more like the startup than being like McDonald's actually sort of works against it in terms of getting to that point of routinizing it and making sure that everybody does it. And one of the ways that I like to kind of recommend people to try and routinize things is to do it via the children, particularly in a secondary school where children go around different teachers, is to encourage the children to ask questions about, when are we going to use the technology? How are we going to use our iPads for this? How are we going to use our iPads for that? And we've certainly seen that even in our small school, we've seen that spread ideas around, you know, Mrs. So-and-so does this with the iPad, can we do that here? And I've had that when new apps have come in, you know, Book Creator, for example. Our drama teacher used it first, and then I had kids come in from drama class and they said, oh, we've used this new app for in drama, can we use that app here, for example? And that's another way that things can become routinized, is actually to use the children as your kind of change agent proxy, if you like, across the school. And they're very keen to do that as well. I suppose one of the things that I take away from this chapter of the book is the idea that setting the agenda and matching the innovation to organizational needs is where you have to get your hook in. That you can't wait until the thing's in your room before you start deciding what you're going to think about it and what you're going to use it for. I think if you want to drive the change, you've got to get right in there, and you've got to be aware. You've got to be involved in your school's development plan. You've got to say, well, I know that we have concerns about STEM, or we have concerns about literacy, or we have concerns about research skills or computing skills in general, or whatever it is. And I can see that we could possibly use whatever technology or innovation you want to bring in, we could use that to match this. And then you get into there and you suggest technologies to match. And I think if I take anything from this, it's that you've got to be in that first half of the process, the agenda setting and the matching. And then, of course, those other things are important too. And they're kind of the yeoman work that has to happen afterwards. But in general, if you don't get in there, somebody else is going to decide that for you. And that's the thing that I take away from the chapter, really, is the agenda setting and the matching is where the action happens, and the rest is just work. And it's hard work, and it's long work, and it's the work of years, but it's still just work after that. Also, framing the innovation in terms of your language is important. So we know this from politics and various things. You know, is it Lakoff, I think, the guy who has written a couple of books about why the American right are typically very good at framing things in terms of such things as death panels and death taxes. And the language that you use around these things is very important. And you see quite often or more and more people talking about modern technology, modern computer deployments. And you have heard me use that language on the show as well. And talking about Windows as a legacy and talking about iPads as modern. I don't say mobile devices, I say modern computing. And you see what I'm doing there is I'm playing with words and I'm playing with the possibility of trying to change people's perceptions by presenting the what is indeed current technology as modern and presenting the legacy, the incumbent technology as legacy technology. And you can hear me play with that, and I've certainly done it on the show before, and I do it when I'm presenting as well, because what that does is it changes people's mindset a little bit, whereas people coming out of schools might think that, well, Windows is what everybody uses and this newfangled iPad stuff. Whereas, in fact, if you look at the numbers, and Benedict Evans from A16Z did a great presentation recently at the Record conference where he showed that when you look at the numbers, the default platform now is mobile platforms. And desktop computing as a whole, as big as it has ever been, is just a tiny fraction of the overall computing landscape now, just because of the sheer scale of mobile devices. And presenting it that way tends to shape a lot of people's opinions towards it. And finally, this whole thing about routinizing, that it becomes, if you're in a position of leadership and management, one of the most important things you can do is try and make sure that your deployment becomes a permanent and expected part of practice in the school. And that's that McDonald's standardization part again. Like every day, you know, do we get our iPads out? Yes or no? What do we do with our iPad? You know, every teacher is going to have a different answer to that. But I think the thing maybe I would be looking for as a school leader would be, are we using them, yes or no, as a first step? And when we certainly brought iPads into Cedars, that was the first thing we asked was, how much are we using them? And I can tell you, when we got those iPad 1s back at the end of our 3-year deployment, we could tell that people had used them to death, because every one of them looked like the outside of the Millennium Falcon. They were all dirty and scratched and chipped and beat up. And that's exactly what you want in the deployment. The last thing you want is after 3 years to be handed back pristine devices that look like they've never been used, because then you've just spent a whole bunch of money down the drain for nothing. So that's innovation in organizations. That's chapter 10 of the book. We will probably do one more show on this, just to look at the consequences of innovations chapter, or we might just wrap that up in the first half of the next show. But that's us for this week, innovation organizations. I hope people have enjoyed this series. I've certainly enjoyed doing it. I know Bradley has too. Bradley's going to be off again next week, so I'm hoping to have a guest on next week. And then Bradley will be back 2 weeks' time. Until then, I'm Fraser Spears on Twitter, spears.org on the web. Thanks to our two sponsors, Jam Software and Shobi. And we'll talk to you all again next week.